From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
And joining us now is John Dunn. He is an author who recently released The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. John, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we have to start by asking, why hummingbirds? What got you so fascinated with these bird species?
Well, I guess you have to understand where I'm calling you from. I live in the United Kingdom in the Shetland Islands, so that's really far north, halfway between Scotland and Norway, effectively. But I'm not from there originally. I grew up in the southwest of England, and you know, we've got some great birds there, but nothing which compares to the colour and iridescence of hummingbirds. And as a young boy, my mum took me up to London and the Natural History Museum, and that was the only thing I cared about seeing in London. I didn't care about the black cabs and the red London buses and all that touristy stuff. I just wanted to go and see the Natural History Museum. And when I was in there, I just stumbled across a cabinet of taxidermied hummingbirds. Now, I know that's kind of black and, you know, quite a dark thing, lots of dead birds, but I'd never seen birds like them. You know, it's just that the colours and the shapes and the forms were so unlike any birds which I was seeing in our little garden down in the south of England. And that was where it all began. I knew that one day I wanted to see more real ones, living ones. And that was the seed sown.
So how many continents, what is the coverage of hummingbirds? And how many continents did you visit to observe these birds?
Sure. So they're found right through the Americas from Tierra del Fuego in the very southern tip of South America, spanning Argentina and Chile, right the way up through to the top of the U.S. In Alaska. And in a kind of nice coincidence for me as a writer as well as a naturalist, the most northerly hummingbirds in the world are rufous hummingbirds, which are found at a latitude of 60 degrees north. And it just so happens that where I live in Shetland is 60 degrees north as well. So I'm closer to the Arctic Circle than I am to London. And, you know, the equivalent, those hummingbirds are existing really far north, way beyond most people would even think a hummingbird possibly could be. But there they are.
We also learned from your book that there are over 300 species of hummingbirds. And I think, you know, here in Utah, we have a handful we see coming through. Give us a sense of the variety of these birds and how they differ.
Sure. So, yeah, there's over 300 species, and incredibly, new ones are still being discovered all the time. You know, we like to think we've kind of got a handle on the birds and the mammals, even if there are a lot of invertebrates and so on out there, which we still don't know about. But amazingly, there are still new species of hummingbirds being found, particularly especially in South America, because hummingbirds have evolved and speciated in incredibly specific little pockets of habitat in the Andes. So there are species which are found, you know, on one sort of little patch of mountain range or in one particular large river valley. And so the capacity for new species being out there and still to be found is still pretty significant. They've evolved in pretty much every habitat the Americas has to offer. So we've sort of touched on the fact that some are found right up in the north in the sort of boreal woods of Alaska and right down in the southern tip of South America on the shores of the Beagle Channel. But they're found in deserts in Arizona, up above the tree line in the Andes in the Paramo, so between the tree line and the snow line in that really high montane habitat, in rainforests, cloud forests, on Caribbean islands, and even out on Isla Robinson Crusoe, which is, 450, 500 miles off the coast of Chile, out in the Pacific Ocean. Wow. There's a hummingbird found there and only there in the world.
Wow.
So they are amazingly adaptable birds, and and have adapted to a wide range of forms. Their plumage, of course, is famously colourful, but also many of them have got sort of preposterous things like really incredible shaped bills which fit exactly inside the flower of a heliconia, or really long bills, some with amazingly long tail streamers. There's so much variety in form as well as color. I can't get enough of them.
Right. So it's in some cases, they're extremely unique physical makeup and I guess habitat requirements that also puts them at risk, because, you know, they may have adapted to cover a large part of the world, but like you say, some of them are very particular in where they live and what they eat.
Yeah, this is it. And some of them are, as you say, very sensitive to change in that habitat. So a good example, I suppose, would be the one that's found on Isla Robinson Crusoe, the Juan Fernandez firecrown. The official statistics is that there are 1,000 of these birds left on the island, and that's it. And that's a perilously small population by anyone's standards. But while I was on the island, I was chatting to the guys who are tasked with performing sort of conservation work on the island. And they said, "Oh, there's not 1,000 birds. We count the nests every year. There's just 400 birds left." And the problem they've got is entirely of mankind's making on the island. It's like a perfect storm. It's kind of a parable for how we've all over the world messed things up inadvertently and sometimes, you know, knowingly. On the island, there are rats, brown rats and black rats, and also mice. And we all know what bad news rodents are for island endemic birds. There's also a burgeoning population of... Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, we should note that those rats are probably not native, not endemic to the island, right?
That's absolutely right. They came with the first European visitors to the islands, the Spanish and latterly the British navies and privateers back in the 16th and 17th century. Who the rats were and the mice were on the boats, and of course, you know, when the boats were more just offshore, they made their way to land. But I mean, the Spanish also introduced goats onto the island at one point in the 17th century, so that they would then have a resource of meat whenever they wanted to stop and stock up the boats in the future. So there's goats on the island. The Spanish also introduced cats. Obviously, they must have been escapees from the boat, but, you know, once you've got cats, that's a problem. Yeah. And what else have we got on the island? There's rabbits, which have been introduced onto the island. There are also, and this beggars belief, coatimundi have been introduced to the island, and they are omnivorous mammals, which really are bad news for native species. And then just to compound all of that, the forestry, the native plants on the island, and it is a hotbed of botanical endemism, are being largely replaced with eucalyptus, which have been planted as a timber. And someone at some point in the past thought it would be a great idea to introduce blackberries and brambles as a stock-proof hedge around the garden. And, of course, those get spread by any bird which eats the juicy blackberries and poops the seeds out. And so those are out-competing the understory, the native vegetation. So in every way, shape, or form, the habitat itself and the birds in particular are under immense pressure. And... you know, that stuff plays out all over the Americas in one way, shape, or form.
You know, it is interesting. All those things you mentioned, I think, are issues that we've probably covered in, you know, another location as well. It's so representative of, like, the invasive species or the habitat loss.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I have to imagine it's all compounded by a changing climate.
Mm. Very much so. And particularly for montane species, the ones which are found in the Andes at high altitude, because of course, as the habitat warms up and perhaps rainfall and so on changes, the vegetation will change as well, and that's the vegetation which these birds will have evolved to coexist with. And all hummingbirds famously are large consumers of nectar, and they'll have specialized plants which they'll rely on to feed from. And as that habitat changes, perhaps the plants themselves will find that they're no longer the habitat is no longer suitable for them, and so the birds are, and the plants are pushed uphill. But you know, there's only so much uphill you can do before that runs out. Climate change is definitely an issue. And I mean, closer to home for you guys, I mean, I imagine in Utah you'll be familiar with rufous hummingbirds.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're a species which has declined catastrophically in the US in the past 50 or so years. Mm-hmm. Their numbers have plummeted by, I think it's a shade over 60% since 1966. Their population has reduced. And now, nobody's entirely sure why that is, but yet you have to think that agriculture will have played some part in this because of the increasing use of pesticides and also habitat loss will be part of it. But what's really interesting is their wintering grounds have always been Mexico, and they move north into the U.S. to breed. But they're now starting to winter in Florida as well. So stuff is changing. And you know, we none of us can entirely predict what the consequences will be. But certainly, the survey work that's been taking place in the U.S. for decades now is charting a decline. And it's not just the hummingbirds. I think I'm right in saying that America's overall avifauna is estimated to decline by approximately a third, or 29%. Since 1970, and that's a net loss of some 3 billion birds of all species. And that's really depressing, isn't it? When we talk about hummingbirds, it's just really joyous. But well, this stuff worries me. And I mean, heavens, you've got it better than we have in the UK. I'm not pointing a finger here.
Yeah.
Our farmland birds have declined by almost 50% in the same time since 1970.
Wow.
It's there's some bad stuff going on.
Yeah, well, John, it's our weekly theme. We do a show
okay.
on and about the environment, John. So sadly, wow, this is the challenges we have.
Is
one
I'm
example.
Beating a familiar drum.
Yeah, exactly. So, and by the way, we're speaking with John Dunn. He is a naturalist and author of the new book, The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. So I got a question from a young listener, wants to know, do hummingbirds, any hummingbird, have a caw, or do they seem to be a quiet species other than hearing their wings beating? Do any of them have an actual caw?
This is a really good question. If you listen carefully, and particularly if you watch them when they're at a hummingbird feeder, you might hear some interaction between them because they defend nectar source, especially the males. And so if one male is feeding and another male bird turns up, there's sometimes a quick exchange of sort of angry chattering and chittering, but it's all very high-pitched. But this was one of the things I learned during my travels. There's one species found in Brazil called the black jacobin, and this actually has one of the highest frequency bird calls of any bird species known. Most birds are communicating somewhere in the range of 2 to 3 or 4 kilohertz, but the black jacobins are communicating with calls in the range of 10 to 14 kilohertz. That's just about beyond the range of human hearing as well. So they've got their own private frequencies. So your listener who's asking, you know, he can't hear them all the time. Well, the black jacobins, he's absolutely right. You wouldn't be able to hear them. They've got their own private frequency which they're communicating with. And people think this is because they're in such a biodiverse place where there's tons of other birds and invertebrates and amphibians, which are all calling as well. And so perhaps the black jacobins have evolved to have for them, a quiet space where they're not being interrupted.
That's fascinating. And I think hummingbirds are so are unique, like in the world of birds. They have these incredibly fast, right, like wing beats and heart rates and all those kinds of things as well, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the sort of thing which defines a hummingbird is that hovering flight. But to make that actually possible, it's just a host of amazing things. Their breast muscles, their pectoral muscles, their flight muscles make up about a third of their body weight, which is almost twice what most other birds have in terms of muscle mass for flight. And you're right, the heart beats, an active hummingbird's beat, its heart is beating in the range of 1,000 to 1,200 beats per minute, which is an astonishing piece of machinery, isn't it? And yet, you know, we were talking about the ones which exist really high up in the Andes. You know, it gets really cold up there, especially at night, and they drop into a state of torpor at night when they slow their heart rates down to 100 or less beats per minute. And their body temperature drops, and I just think this is awesome. Their body temperature drops, but it's just a couple of degrees above the ambient air temperature around them, and that could be close to the point of freezing.
Wow.
And I've heard that described as a state of controlled hypothermia, which I think is a really cool way to describe it. And that way they go through the night not needing the same sort of high energy intake which their metabolisms normally demand. And then as the day warms up at dawn, then they kind of reanimate and off they go again. It's awesome.
And along the same lines, talk about their appetite or the requirement for food. How much of their body weight do they have to consume each day?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't actually know what it is in terms of body weight. You've got me there. It doesn't sound like a lot. They're eating in the order of 3 to 8 calories a day. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, does it? You know, we're told to keep our calorie intake down to something rather more than that. But if we had a Hummer metabolism, we'd be needing to consume around 150,000 calories a day. So these guys are burning, effectively high octane fuel with their metabolisms and consuming nectar to power them.
But they also eat a lot of insects too, or at least I'm familiar with species that consume a lot of bugs that I didn't think I thought they were just like nectar based. But they also
That's right. I mean, and they all do this. They all consume invertebrates, whether it's flies or spiders. And of course, they're really kind of consumers of spiders. They use their silks and their webs to help bind their nests together. So, they all need protein. And people who I met during my travels who have helped to rehabilitate injured hummingbirds. One of the real challenges for someone who's got a poorly hummingbird is keeping that protein intake. And effectively, you buy powdered protein to put into the sugar water that you're feeding the injured hummingbird, so that it's getting what it would normally acquire from foraging for insects itself.
Okay, Nell and I are looking at that. We did not know that.
Protein powder is not just for humans, for the gym, right?
Well, these birds work out 20 hours a day, so.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I found at every turn the hummingbirds had surprises. I was learning new stuff, cool stuff, just all the time. And this goes for everyone, for natural history writers and sort of, you know, keen amateur naturalists like me, right through to scientists. There's still so much to learn about them. For years, people postulated that they fed. You know, you've seen a hummingbird dipping its tongue into a flower or a feeder. A hummingbird's tongue has got like a tiny little groove or tube in it. And people thought, oh, they're feeding by capillary action. But you know, when you think about it, the amount of time a hummingbird's tongue is in a flower, immersed in nectar, there's no way that could work. And it was only when researchers using a hummingbird feeder, a clear hummingbird feeder and high-speed camera, were watching a hummingbird's tongue dipping into the nectar, they realized that when it's immersed in nectar, it kind of unfolds, and there are tons of tiny little flaps which open all the, along the length of the tongue. And then when the tongue is retracted back into the hummingbird, all of this closes up again. And it's simply the action of the hummingbird pumping its tongue in and out, which draws the nectar, it traps it in the tongue, and then as it pumps its tongue back out again, it squirts the nectar back into the hummingbird's throat. And so, yes, they're amazing biomechanical creatures, and there's so much to learn about them still. Wonderful.
Well, the book is totally a joy to read, full of fascinating information like you're talking, you know, you're referencing here. I'm curious, of all the, you know, incredible places that you visited and all of the hundreds of species that you saw, were there, you know, one or two that stood out to you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
1 minute. There were a couple. sorry, Dave, 1 minute. To summarize that question.
There were a couple of species which I knew from the offset. I really wanted to see. They're kind of totemic ones amongst birders. There's one in Peru called the marvelous spatial tail, which has most preposterous long tail feathers with these big sort of discs of sort of indigo blue on the end. And yeah, that was the first bird which I'd ever seen. And I've seen a lot of birds around the world, but it's the first one I'd ever seen which I discovered literally as well as figuratively. My jaw dropped. You know, it was just the most outlandish bird. It was breathtakingly
amazing. We're looking at it
amazing.
Now in the book, on the plate.
Oh,
yes.
And by the way, the book has beautiful color plates, photographs, and
which you
took most of. It seems like you took quite a few of them.
I took all of them.
Well then, sorry about that. I'll give you all the credit.
That's okay. I'm a writer first and foremost. Well, I'm a naturalist first and foremost. I enjoy writing about the stuff I see and hopefully enthusing people to care about it. But yeah, I do like to take a picture or two as well. So I was thrilled to get some color plates in there as well.
Well, the name of the book is The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. The author is naturalist John Dunn. The book is available now. Again, it's a great read and beautiful color photographs of these amazing species, hummingbirds. John, do you have a website that people can go to learn more about your work?
I do. It's simply my name. It's johndunn.com. I'm most active on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is @DunnJohns.
That's Dunn, D-U-N-N. John, thanks again for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.